today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for talking to me today.
Well, the book is fascinating. It's very interesting. I do tons of interviews here and very rarely actually read the books because I usually look at the press kit. I actually opened it up and ended up finishing it. It's called A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, On the Ground in Baghdad, Before, During, and After the War by Richard Engel. And it's an amazing book. Hyperion published it, so you can all go out and get your copy. But, sometimes I thought you were foolish. Sometimes I thought you were pretty smart. Sometimes I thought you were a little too daring. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up in Iraq and the whole thing. It's an interesting story. I know you can't tell us in 2 minutes what you wrote in the book, but...
Well, it's a long journey that took me to Iraq. I left for the Middle East in 1996, and I moved to Cairo, and I set up shop in Cairo and learned the language and became interested in the region. I went over there because I wanted to be a journalist, and I thought the Middle East would be a good story, and that getting first-hand knowledge would become a valuable skill. And after 4 years in Cairo, I was moved to Jerusalem, covered that story for 3 years. And then when the countdown to the war in Iraq began, I determined that this was the moment. This was going to be the defining moment in the Middle East for this decade anyway. So I... managed to get myself in the country. I couldn't get a regular visa, so I had to sneak in and get a human shield visa, and then tried to convert it, and that was a whole...
You had to go outside the country, sir.
I had to go outside the country and come back and hide my equipment and then come back and managed to eventually secure the right reporting credentials, then managed to secure a deal at the time with ABC News, because I was mostly doing radio and some freelance things for ABC before then. And then everyone left, which was surprising to me. And
it was you and Peter Arnett until Peter got thrown out.
Until Peter had his run in.
Right.
And then, I was in this, this very unique position. And I was doing what I really wanted to do. And, I guess it was a fortunate position because people got to see what I'd been doing for a long time.
There were times, I know, in reading in the book that, being an American, while Americans were bombing these people, it was a difficult situation. There was a couple of times you were in tense situations where you were circled with people and you never knew what was going to happen.
You didn't. The emotions are riding high. There's no law and order. If someone had wanted to pull out a pocket knife and stab me in the chest, there would have been no repercussions. So but people in general I found were kind, and I never had any direct hostility at me. People always made a distinction between who I was and what the government was doing, though I did fear I would run into that one irate family member or neighbor or nutcase who would do something violent.
One of the things I thought was, really valuable here is the fact that you knew the language, because I know that journalists that are there, sometimes the translators will actually translate things differently to change the whole context of what's going on. You were able to actually know what was going on all the time because you knew the language.
It's valuable. I think if you're there in a dangerous situation, I think it's the key thing is, in my limited knowledge, is that you want to stay in control as much as possible. Things that are outside of your control, you can't handle. But for everything that you can control, you want to be. And if you don't speak the language, then you're under someone else's control. You're at the mercy of your translators to figure out what's going on. And I think that would have been... Maybe I was able to be calm because I wasn't dependent on other people for information. So I was in an unfamiliar location, and if the language is unfamiliar and you don't understand what's going on around you, perhaps it could be more intimidating than if you understand it and you've lived there for a while. And so my comfort level was already relatively high, so I think that helped me tolerate the uncomfortable situation that is the war in Iraq now.
And today there was a terrible tragedy in Iraq again, with Iraqis killing Iraqis.
A lot of them. This was a very significant event. Dozens of Iraqis killed in this what apparently coordinated suicide bombing campaign in Baghdad and Karbala to coincide with a Shiite religious holiday. This is a very significant event, and hopefully it won't trigger the Shiites to respond with a series of revenge killings, but that's always the danger, that we're going to have some sort of sick cycle of ethnic violence within the country that so far hasn't really happened.
Are you still staying in Iraq at all?
I'm heading back tonight.
Really? So what do you think is going on in terms of, I know that the U.S. government plans to try to turn over power at some point.
June 30th is the deadline to transfer of power.
Can you see this actually happening?
Something will happen. We're going to have a handover of power, if it's a symbolic handover or if it's an actual. We're not going to have all the troops leave and wash our hands of Iraq on June 30th, but we will have a transfer of authority. We'll give the Iraqi ministries more sovereignty. It'll be more the Iraqis' responsibility to be patrolling the streets. There'll be somewhat of a pullback of the American presence, but we're, in terms of their visibility on the streets of Iraq, but we're still going to be there. We're still going to be ultimately, until Iraq is up and running, we'll still ultimately be in charge, I think.
Even up and running, the Islamic militancy is so deep and it's so threatening. It's amazing if you look at Iraq. I mean, they hate Americans, but they hate the Jews worse. It seems to me like no matter what government you prop up there, they have to be strong enough to resist all these, you know, wild Islamic militants on the sidelines there.
There are a lot of crazy Islamic militants running around Baghdad and Iraq right now. The chaos has attracted them, and this is their place to do battle. And there are new ones being, you know, born among the chaos that is there right now. But they're a small portion of the population. Most people in Iraq don't want these. They don't want these issues, and they don't. These Islamic militant groups think they're fighting a war, but among Muslims that happened 1,400 years ago between Shiites and Sunnis. Most Iraqis just want a more modern, progressive, Western-looking state. They would love to have what we have in the United States. You know, democracy and an economy that works and respect on the international scene.
The question is, do they have leaders that can pull that off?
They have leaders. They have leaders, and they have a lot of educated Iraqis. And the problem is the competing, the same way we had a balance in the formation of this country between, you know, states' rights and national sovereignty. We're going through that battle right now in Iraq, and which groups, until they come up with a comfort level between the main ethnic groups there, there's going to be violence as they push each other and test, and who's going to end up on top.
My own feeling on
this, a violent process.
My own feeling is really that the leadership is the most important issue here, because if they don't have a strong leadership, they're going to end up like the Palestinians, who, if they had really good leadership that really cared about their people, they would have already had a sovereign nation and probably been doing a lot of trading with Israel and probably been friends and neighbors at this point.
The Palestinians are much more unified than the even though they have many factions within their group, at least they all see themselves as Palestinians. Here in Iraq, you have the Shiites who are Shiite Iraqis, and you have the Kurds who are Kurds, and secondary, they are Iraqis. And then you have the Sunnis who see themselves as the legitimate rulers of this country, of that country.
This is an amazing thing for you. How does it feel to be part of history like this? I mean, it must be amazing.
I feel privileged. I like it. I would can't imagine doing anything else. I mean, I like watching history go by and feeling that at least I'm getting a front row seat.
Do you ever, what are your political feelings here? I mean, do you utter them? What do you think about the whole war as it is? Was it a proper war?
My job was not to, you know, I just watch and bring home the news. So I really see myself as, you know, as an observer. We'll see. Was this a good idea or not? It's too early to tell. It was a great, you know, removing Saddam was a noble thing. Saddam was a horrible dictator. But will this turn out to be a success story? Yes. We'll know that if there's another war in the region.
What do you think about the Israeli-Palestinian and the peace plan and the maps and all this stuff? Is there any way that's ever going to work out?
Yeah, I mean, that's not, I mean, sure. We were close once. We seem to have not focused on it for quite some time. The leadership there is a bit entrenched. But
if you look at what happened in Oslo in 93, there were five things that were told for each side to do. The Israelis complied with four of the five, and controversially, maybe even five. The Palestinians, zero out of the five. So where is there going to be room for negotiation and peace there if one side's not...
They've been pretty close, and I think similarly, but most sides over there are sick of living in fear and are sick of the conflict. Palestinians are tired of having the Israelis, you know, going through their homes with, you know, through their towns and villages with tanks, and the Israelis are tired of living in fear that their coffee shops are going to blow up. So, with the right leadership and the right commitment from the United States, I think it can be done. That the will is there.
What about the wall? What's your feelings on that? I assume you've seen it up close.
I have, and though I've been in Iraq, I must admit, for the last year, but I lived in Jerusalem for 3 years before then, and so I'm familiar with that conflict, and I lost friends on both sides. My neighbor, an Israeli, was killed, and some of my good friends are Palestinians were killed. So the wall looks ugly, but I can sympathize. I can understand why the Israelis want to put it up, but if you could figure out where to put it, if you put it, you know, on a border that they can both agree on, I don't think anyone, either side, would have a real objection with it.
Mm. Well, the question is, where can they agree on, and they don't seem to be agreeing.
No, that's the way. Now, where do you put it? That's the problem.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about some of the other countries there, Egypt that you've been, Syria, Libya, all the countries that surround this region. What are your feelings toward them? Are they? Yeah, in Saudi Arabia, which side are they taking? Are they
in the Iraq conflict?
Yeah, in the Iraq conflict, and also with the Middle East. I can see that the whole thing from '67, where all the Arab nations got together to mm-hmm. try to overthrow Israel, could happen again very shortly once all this other stuff is ironed out.
It could happen, though. I think other governments would rather not bother with it, to be perfectly honest. Egypt, for example, it has a very explosive population. It's very poor. They're going through a tremendous economic crisis right now. But they don't want to go to war with Israel and all the work, all their bridges that they've spent so much money and time to put up, and all their infrastructure projects, to have that all, you know, destroyed in a week. And they don't... What's the point? I don't think they have any interest. They would rather push the peace process forward because they have a... They feel they have a moral obligation to help the Palestinians. The same way a lot of the governments in the region aren't keen to go to war. In terms of the Iraq situation, they're watching that one very closely, particularly the neighboring countries. Saudi Arabia, it might be uncomfortable to have a powerful Shiite state on its borders, on its border, that has close relations with Iran, which is what will happen because the Shiites and Iran are pretty much ideologically on the same page. That's a potential source of tension. The Syrians, they're not doing anything right now. They're pretty frightened, I think, after the war and after they were in the U.S. crosshairs for so long. But the situation is very volatile. Hezbollah, in Lebanon, is another wild card.
Mm.
So there's enough work over there to keep me busy for a while.
I guess so. Now, from a point of view of someone who's read the book and really enjoyed it, are your drivers still there? The folks you're still connected with before still with you?
Yeah, the characters, and I still see them regularly. Some of them have fared well, and some of them haven't. You know, I think it was the 10 or 15 people I got close with during the war, I think are an accurate, or a representative cross-section of society.
I would assume, is Ali your best friend there? Or?
Ali is a sad case. You know, Ali was a nice guy, sweet kid. He was my driver throughout the war, and he was the one. He was just fiercely loyal and honest, but naive and shy at the same time. it was just too much for him. He's drawn into his shell. He doesn't go out much. He's broken down.
That's too bad.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. Maybe he'll come out of it. But I've tried to. I want to get him a job. I've tried to motivate him, but he's not motivated.
Your first driver was your typical sleazy kind of guy.
Yeah, I see him all the time. He still smiles at me, and I ignore him. He comes over and, you know, gives me a big hug, and I'm like, you know, buzz it. Beat it, character.
So out of the 20 grand you had attached to your ankle, how much do you have left?
Well, no, it's, I basically spent it all. I had some of it with my own money, so I brought it back home, but I spent most of it.
Yeah.
I had eight or nine hotel rooms, and I had eight drivers, and I bought generators, and, you know, I spent a lot of money.
You certainly did. I mean, you were playing every possible angle you could play.
Well, you know, you don't know what's going to happen.
Are you still doing that now? I mean,
Now I work for NBC, so it's a bigger organization, and we have a bureau, and we have other people there, and I have, you know, there's camera crews and producers and satellite uplinks, and it's a different game.
Because before you were doing the same, you had to carry the satellite stuff with you, your digital camera, everything, and you had to try to hide it from the authorities. It was like a cat and mouse game the whole
time. It was a different game. You know, it was running around with your equipment and hiding it at night, and now we operate openly. We're free to go where we want. So it's a great place to report now. You can, you know, just go out and do anything. The story is developing. You just have to go out and do it and hopefully not get hurt.
How are you going to feel on March 17th when it comes up, the anniversary?
It'll be a time of reflection, but I'm not going to have any emotional, you know, I'll be busy. I'll be, you know, producing news and chasing stories.
That's what you're supposed to do. The book is called A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, and Richard Engel has written it. It's from Hyperion, and it's a fascinating book, and go get it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hey, good luck. Stay healthy.
Hey, take it easy.
Bye.